questions you've been carrying around with you about mindfulness or Buddhism, and Jonathan always has questions. It's with him in the audience, I should have known it was. Please.
One just sort of, I have two questions on my mind. One is, I notice I'm getting back pain sitting, and I'm wondering, do you typically recommend sort of decreasing the height of the cushion or increasing it, or are there any kind of like typical mistakes in sitting that seem to cause back pain?
So are there typical mistakes in sitting meditation that can cause back pain? And he wanted to know about different heights of cushions, whether it make a difference. It can make a difference, and it depends on what's going on in your spine, whether you want to go sit higher or lower. You might want to experiment. But the operating principle, I believe, is not so much the height, but is rather the curvature in your back. You want to sit certainly straight, but straight is not, you know, like a ruler. It's good to have a little bit of curve in the lower part of your back. Now, some people overarch, and people overarch, sometimes it's good to sit lower. And people who underarch or flat sometimes cave out, kind of bulge out. And it's usually better than sit up higher. So have really good support under your sitting bones. And if you sit sometimes too far back on the cushion or too far forward on the cushion, that can also give you kind of not the right support here underneath the kind of. To kind of, so you can kind of see, so it makes it more difficult to sit along the center of gravity, which is what you want to do. If a person is leaning forward or leaning backward, even just very slightly, and the center of gravity is projected forward, backwards, or to the side, the muscles in the spine have to work a lot harder, and they get tired after a while and they start hurting. Sometimes people's have bad posture to begin with. They spend a lot of time, for example, over a keyboard. And so they're sitting in a chair a lot in this sloppy posture, and so the upper part of the back is kind of curved excessively, and sometimes it's kind of locked. It's been kind of frozen there for a long time, and then they're not used to holding. When any part of the back is out of alignment or curved out or curved in or whatever too much, then the muscles of the back have to work a lot harder, and so they get tired and they can hurt, or muscles which have not been used for a long time suddenly come into play and they get tired. So you have to make sure that you're sitting along the center of gravity, and sometimes swaying back and forth and ensuring that's happening. Sometimes lifting up like one shoulder to your ear, and then taking and stretching your arm all the way around in a big circle can open up the shoulders a little bit, and have your shoulder blades kind of backwards and allow them to open up, so the shoulder blades can begin falling down your back. If you're too curved, the shoulder blades have no place to move. But if you're sitting upright, they can relax and come down. Where does your back hurt?
Like in the middle of the lumbar area.
So yeah, I can't tell you, higher or lower. One of the things, I had back problems sometimes in my back, and one of the things that I found helpful was relaxing all these muscles around the whole muscles all around my waist. And then also I would relax my thigh muscles, and somehow I didn't get a sense that I made much difference, if I looked at it or something, but somehow softening the tops of my thighs seemed to have an effect on my lower back. So if I relaxed all this area around here and relaxed my thighs, it seemed to improve, it kind of reduced the pressure and the vertebrae there. And your second question?
Can you use meditation to help you make decisions?
What's the question?
How can you use meditation to help make decisions? Well, that's a good question. There's the kind of logical answers and the illogical answers to that question. And the logical answer is that you can, for example, spend time in meditation or in mindfulness practice looking at your motivation and looking at your reactivity around an issue. So you can just look at all that goes on in your mind. When the mind is very quiet and very still and not kind of running off in the future or being excessively reactive to something, sometimes you can see an issue much more clearly. And one of the things you want to see is what your motivation is. And sometimes just clarifying what the motivation is can help with a decision quite easily. So for example, if you know that your motivation is somehow unwholesome, then all the other reasons for doing something might just be irrelevant. Because, you know, why do you want to follow through on an unwholesome motivation? You're harming yourself in doing that. Also, it's possible to do in meditation. There's a whole repertoire of forms of meditation besides just mindfulness. And one of them is reflective meditation, where you're kind of thinking about a theme. And you might, for example, you might sit in meditation and get as quiet as you possibly can. And then once you're pretty quiet, you would pop the question. And then you'd see what bubbles up. You don't have to engage in the question in a thoughtful way. Just hold the issue there in front of you. Hold it in the mind, or hold it in your belly, or something. Hold it someplace in your heart, and then see what kind of wells up. Maybe it's feelings, maybe it's thoughts, maybe it's reactions, maybe something. And you might give you a very different relationship to that thing than you would otherwise. When I have to make often sometimes big decisions, I don't often turn to my mindfulness meditation practice to help me. I don't just sit down to meditate, for example, to help with the decision. I'll do all the things I've talked about in the sense of looking at my motivation and all that, and my reactions. But if I'm going to think about it some, I found it very useful to go for a long walk. And something, the process of the rhythmic walking, I get into kind of a little bit of a concentration with it. And I see my thinking seems to be much more creative and active, and I just let my thinking kind of go on a topic and kind of roam around kind of freely. And sometimes my thinking seems to find its own way through it. I don't like feel like I'm the person who's, you know, thinking even. Just thinking is going on, it's concentrated on this topic, and it finds its way, and sometimes clarity can come. And the most illogical answer is that where meditation can help. Well, this is what I found for myself, and that is that if I do my homework around an important issue, and homework means I have to reflect on it and think about it, maybe talk to my friends about it and look at different angles of it, and not just, you know, expect that by magic, you know, I'll know that what to do. I have to do my homework in some ways, be engaged in it in a thoughtful way. But I don't necessarily expect that that's where the answer is going to come, the decision is going to come, but I have to do my homework part of it. And then if I do something like go into meditation or do something which kind of enters my mind into a little altered state, sometimes the answer will just bubble up by itself out of the blue. And then I'll know. And so some of the biggest decisions in my life have been that way, where I've done some reflection beforehand, and then in some altered state, I wasn't even asking a question anymore, but something would well up inside of me. And maybe one of the clearest examples is when I graduated from college, and I'd been living for about a year at the San Francisco Zen Center. But I was planning in September to go back to graduate school at UC Berkeley. And I guess UC Berkeley, I think they start in late August, maybe, the quarter. So it got to be, I think, like, so I was accepted and it's all set to go, and I was living at Green Gulch Farm in Marin County. And I was very happy there, and then it kind of, the first day of August came around, and I realized, oh, I'm supposed to go to school, graduate school in a few weeks. And I haven't, you know, found a place to live over in Berkeley, and I know it's hard to find a place over there, and even back then. And I said, oh, I better. And so suddenly it dawned on me I had to kind of consider what I was going to do with my life. And the options for me was to go to graduate school or to go to Tassajara, the Zen monastery in Carmel Valley. And so I thought about it for a while. You know, it was involved with a question. It's a short, actually relatively short time. But then I went and participated in a ritual that the Zen Center does every day. Did it every day at noon, chanting the Heart Sutra. And I'd done this for a year, chanting the Heart Sutra, and was kind of, but the chanting of it was kind of like mantric effect, kind of got me very concentrated, very still, and somehow in the middle of chanting that Heart Sutra, somehow the answer welled up from my body. It was literally a feeling it had. It wasn't like my mind came to this decision. The decision welled up from inside of me. I said, "Oh, Tassajara." And it was so clear to me, that answer, that I immediately followed the teacher of the Green Gulch out of that ritual into his, where he was going, and said, cornered him and said, "I'm going to Sahara." And then I called up UC Berkeley and said that something important had come up and I wouldn't be able to go to graduate school this year, and could they hold my application for a year? And they said, "Sure." Probably still waiting for me. Yes, Rainbow.
Jonathan's first question reminded me that I have been interested in certain aspects of how we sit, and that is mudras. I don't remember you ever talking about how our hands are and what each of the positions represent the statues of the Buddha.
Right.
And I just love looking at them and trying to figure out what they all signify. And I also was wondering if you could just simplify how we are to sit with our hands here. I think it's left hand on the top. Yep. Our hands with our thumbs together, but I'd like you to stay.
In the Vipassana tradition that we're teaching here, there's usually no definitive instruction about what to do with your hands. When I give the introductory course, I mostly just say, do the same thing with both hands, so they're symmetrical. So, you know, don't have one hand in your pocket and one, you know, doing the same thing, basically. And anything that's basically is comfortable, and so, and where you're holding your hands in such a way that you're not putting any strain on your neck or your shoulders. Sometimes if the hands are too far forward or down, it pulls the shoulders and it can cause strain. And but the hands can be pointing down, they can be up, they can be on the lap, on the knees, they can be together, they can be, if you're sitting cross-legged, they can be in the ankle or the heel, they can be up, lifted up. There's a whole range of ways I don't have one way. In the Zen tradition, they have one way you're supposed to do it. And that's the way you described, where the left hand goes on top. And it's said just so the fingers overlap, so the fingers don't go across into your palm. And then you close your thumb, so you're just very, very lightly touching. It said sometimes, so that there's just enough pressure in your thumb, they can enough to hold a piece of paper there without it falling out. And it's called the cosmic mudra. It's kind of like an egg, I guess. Maybe that's why. And like I've heard, you know, rumors or guesses that somehow the left hand is the wisdom hand and the right hand is compassion, and you need more wisdom when you sit, so you put your left hand on top or something. I don't know. I probably have it wrong. There are traditionally in the iconography of Buddhism different gestures which mean something, and this is the one we just talked about, is usually the meditation gesture, sit in meditation. There is the kind of a teaching gestures of a couple of different types, where you hold your fingers like your thumb together like this, and you know, or sometimes the two hands together with the thumbs kind of closed but overlapping inside each other. And then there's the earth touching gesture, which where the one hand is over the knee of the Buddha, and is touching. That's the teaching gesture up there, but touching the earth, and that symbolizes, represents the moment in which the Buddha was awakened, or just before he was awakened. The story of his awakening. We called upon the earth to be his witness. And there's a gesture that represents fearlessness, giving the gift of fearlessness. I believe it's like this. The Buddha holds up his hand like this, and that's a meaning the Buddha is kind of showing. It's like when your dog, your dog comes barking, you go like this, right? To show that you're harmless. And then there's one that going pointing down, which I'm not sure what that is. Maybe it's, I'm not sure. You remember, Stephen?
Sometimes it goes.
Fearlessness is both hands like this. And as in esoteric Buddhism or tantric Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism, both in Tibetan Buddhism, and they have in Tibet, and they also have in China and Japan, mudras are very important. And there's a whole, you know, hundreds of different kind of mudras and gestures that a person might learn and practice with. And but in our tradition, it's just very simple. Yeah.
You know, the fact that you had a lecture on the five great losses Buddha had mentioned and taught. Could you review those for me?
The five great losses. You mean maybe the five great fears?
The five great losses, and one of them was loss of one's livelihood.
Yeah, the five fears.
The five fears.
Yeah, the five great fears.
And where are they, please?
What are they? Well, I probably don't remember them well, but something like the fear of death, the fear of becoming insane, the fear of losing one's livelihood, and
public speaking.
Yeah, and I was going to save it for last. And then the fear of public speaking. the fear of not remembering lists. Yes.
Speak a bit about the concept of the hungry
ghost. Oh, the hungry ghost. Ooh. hungry ghost. In Buddhist cosmology, there are, depending on the particular tradition, five or six realms of existence. So, you know, like in Dante, there's four realms, I suppose. There's our worldly realm, the earth, there's hell, there's purgatory, and there's heaven. So, kind of similar kind of cosmology. So, in the bottom, there is the realm of hell. The difference between Dante and the Buddha is that for the Buddha, hell's your residence in hell is always temporary. And from practical terms, it's so phenomenally long sometimes that it feels long. Eternal, and it's very, you know, suffering is so great, but it's always temporary, and so is being born in heaven. But earth, hell is at the bottom.
Tempering
probably also, but it's also temporary. And then there's that's the bottom. One up from the bottom usually often is one up from the bottom. But then there's also the animal realm, which is animal world, and it's characterized by fear, the animal realm. And then there's the earth realm, and then there's the realm of the hungry ghost, and then there's the deva realm, the realm of the gods. And if they have a sixth system, they take one particular kind of god and separate them from the other gods, and they're called the asuras. And the asuras like to fight, and they often fight the gods, so they're kind of wrathful beings. And it's, so heavenly realms are characterized by a lot of bliss and joy. The earth, it's very interesting, the mythology of this, because it's said that, except for one very rare exception, you cannot become enlightened, fully enlightened and liberated, on any plane or any realm of existence besides the earthly one, being a human being. And if you have too much suffering, it's very hard to suffer, to practice, or be interested in practice, or be concentrated enough to practice. And if you have too much bliss, too much recreation opportunities, too much comfort in your life, then it's also very difficult to have the motivation to practice. And so you need to kind of in the middle. You have to be kind of an ordinary human being with the right balance of happiness and suffering to really be able to practice. It's like Dharma teachers in Hawaii say that they have a very hard time getting people to come to their one-day sittings. And people have these, you know, same problems everywhere else, but, you know, they just go to the beach. Here in California, you go to a therapist. And it's cheaper there in Hawaii. So one of these realms is the hungry ghost realm. And the hungry ghosts are beings, ghosts kind of like beings, spirits, that are driven by craving, by thirst and desire. But their suffering arises because they have these very, very huge bellies, this insatiable need, this great need to be filled. But they have this very, 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 very thin throats. And so they just can't get enough food in their mouth down that throat to satisfy that stomach. So they're always unsatisfied, no matter how much they get. And so this is, can represent beings, humans, for whom, no matter how much they get, they always feel empty and hungry and want more of something. And you find people like that. And maybe each of us at times will feel that way. And so hungry ghosts have that nature. So why were you asking?
It's come across my readings from time to time, and I never had quite the grasp of it that I wanted. And I'm interested in what the experience of someone who's unable to move through that period of craving, you know, like things or people or love.
Yeah.
What do you think?
a very the issue of desire and craving and working with that is, you know, really central to our practice. I gave a talk a few weeks ago, didn't I, on desire? So you can probably find the talk. But the one of the things that mindfulness is being used for is not just simply to become calm or, you know, or concentrated or something, but mindfulness, you know, it's much more, actually it's more important for mindfulness practice to use your mindfulness practice to study how your inner life works, how your mind works, and in doing that, start learning how to become independent or free of the mind's reactivity and reactions. So craving is a very powerful force in us, and it's very seductive. It's seductive because it's often has always great promise of pleasure, and it's also seductive because there's a promise of trying to fill an emptiness inside of us, and it doesn't fill emptiness inside of us. It kind of soothes for a little bit, but then the emptiness is always, you know, still there. But it's very seductive to get involved in craving, and so to learn how to see the craving and desire when it's there, see how we tend to react in its presence, and to learn how to be independent of and free of it is a very, very important part of the practice. And in doing that, develop the kind of stability of mind that can actually look much more carefully and kind of behind the curtains of the craving or desire to see what's really operating there. If a person is a hungry ghost, there's some suffering that's really going on behind the desire. And if they can use the mindfulness practice to discover the suffering behind the desire, then they don't have to use a desire anymore to satisfy the suffering, because it's maladaptive. They can just go. So, for example, if desire comes out of a sense of emptiness or loneliness, it's possible to turn the mindfulness back on the emptiness or loneliness and hold yourself in the middle of that, even though it's quite unpleasant, until you find a kind of liberation in the midst of it, and it no longer has any power over you. You might still feel that occasionally, but it loses its power. Yes, Jim?
One of the things I've wanted to do for a long time is experience a Buddhist culture and practice in a Buddhist culture. So, yeah, it's been great. And when I was back at IMS last fall, I met a bunch of people that had practiced in Burma. And so I signed up for a retreat there. And then I started doing some research, and apparently, recently, a number of the Burmese respected people that are in exile, and Aung San Suu Kyi being one, has said, don't go to Burma. They want to support the boycott of Burma.
Even for Dharma practitioners?
Even for, right, that's what they're saying. And so, what do you think?
I don't have any thoughts about it. The regime, Burmese regime, is pretty terrible, and what the best strategy is for making a difference in Burma, I don't know. There are different points of view. One is to this all-out boycott, and the other view is to something as significant as the Dharma, that you're having contact with the West also gives people ideas of that there's alternatives, and people don't feel isolated by the outside world, and some people might feel supported by our presence, and people coming to practice Buddhism in particular are there to really show other values, for example. And people, when they go on retreat in Burma, they're spending very little money. I mean, I probably spent $40 in 8 months when I was there. So it isn't like I was bringing all this, vast amount of wealth to the country to, the government used, and I was and I, that $40 I traded on the black market anyway. So I don't really know what to do with that.
Was it also that way when you went? I mean, were people calling for boycott then, or
not that I knew of. I wasn't so much aware of. Most people in the West weren't so much aware of the Burmese political situation back then, because it really came into, my understanding, came into prominence in 1989 when Aung San Suu Kyi was elected president, and then there was a kind of basically a coup, and the election was overturned by the military, and since then, since it was such a clear violation of democratic principles, then since then it's been well publicized. But it wasn't a democratic country, you know, for 30 years before that, so it wasn't like it was that new. What was happening when I just before I went was that Burma was closed to the West, so it wasn't a matter of, you know, could Westerners go there. Then the government, military government, would just, they wanted to keep everybody out. So, and it could be that they'd be happy if no one came, because that's what their strategy was in the past. And just before I applied to go, they'd opened up. You know, maybe it was only a few months or 6 months before I went, or something like that. So I was one of the first, among the first group of Westerners to go meditate in Burma after a number of years. Well, it wasn't that long. It wasn't closed for that long. I think it was closed for 2 or 3 years. Yes?
I just wanted to say, hi, my name is Barbara, and my son is marrying a Burmese girl who's, she lives here, and her mother and nuns pass through here all the time, so I'd be happy to put you in touch with her if you want the inside scoop. She goes back and forth all the time, and I'm going to go with her too one of these days. So.
Cool.
Yes, please.
Can I respond a little bit more to
sure,
that?
Sure.
When I was in Burma last, which was, 2 years ago, the feeling was that if you didn't go, if you went as a private traveler and didn't give the government money by taking a tour or some official function of that sort, but that was actually encouraged because then you could come back and kind of spread the word about the conditions that you found there and talking to the people. That may have changed since then. But the other thing is that if you want to get a little taste of that closer to home, you could go to the Tangpu Kaba A Monastery down in Boulder Creek. And they get pretty Burmese down there quite frequently.
It is a wonderful thing to go to a traditional Burmese culture, Buddhist culture. Of which there's many in Asia, and it's just wonderful to see some of the Buddhist values being expressed in everyday life and encounters with people in the street and for example in Thailand in Burma to experience the tremendous generosity that people have towards the Dharma and towards each other in many ways. And I was inspired over and over again by the generosity I received in Asia, in Japan, and Thailand, and Burma, and the kindness I received, and the help, and there's many, many beautiful values to be seen, and there's really good practice opportunities here in the West, and there are wonderful practice opportunities in Asia, but mostly I encourage people to go to Asia just for the cultural experience. Yes.
Isn't there a Burmese monastery in Hasnam Bay? Or
there is.
Yeah.
But I think you don't quite get the Burmese. You get a little bit of the Burmese flavor there, but it's kind of more like a. It's kind of small, and it's a kind of a. I don't know how to say it exactly, but I think if you really want to get more of the Burmese flavor, you go up there to Boulder Creek. It's a, you know, it's like, it'd be like going to, difference between going to. If you want to get a taste of American culture, it's like the difference between going to yeah, I am.
My son's getting married in a Burmese Buddhist temple in Fremont. I don't know anything about the size of it or whatever, but I can put you in touch.
The Burmese are just marvelous people. Yeah.
I sat for about 2 months at Rina Sakar, that she was associated there. And very, very affirming. She was super there in the forest tradition of Hatuna in the forest there. The food is Burmese. And the energy is very different.
Yeah.
In there. You're in that world. And many of those monks are political, have sought political asylum. So they would be, even just calling them, they would be able to.
Mm-hmm. The issue of culture, of course, is a very interesting one on many levels. and the Buddhist culture in particular. And as Buddhism has come to the West, a lot of people in America have had to grapple with the question of how much of the Buddhism, the forms in which they're practicing, engaging in, how much of them belong to the culture, Thai or Burmese or Japanese, and how much of it is really essential to Buddhism. And there's, you know, all kinds of answers to that question. It's not a clear, easy thing. But the tradition that you're involved with here, we're already a tradition of our own, even though, you know, it's sometimes invisible. But we're a particular tradition of American Buddhism, which has made all kinds of very conscious decisions about how much to include and exclude. Maybe the word should be exclude, since very little of the Asian forms are here in this room, for example. There's a little bit. You know, we have a Buddha and we have a big bell and we use bells, and many of us sit cross-legged on the floor, but it's pretty minimal what we have. And some people find that refreshing, and some people feel like we've, you know, maybe thrown the baby out with the bathwater. So it's a whole issue that anyone who's involved with, you know, can certainly grapple with, and it's an issue that many people have thought about a lot. And some people who come don't want to think about it at all. They're just content that they feel at home in what we have to offer. Please, Asha.
Can you talk about a little bit what's involved in the practice of the Heart Sutra?
The practice of the Heart Sutra.
Yeah, the chant.
I gave a talk on the Heart Sutra.
You did.
The end of May, I believe. So that's probably available either out there or on our website, where all the Dharma talks are available. You can listen to off your computer or store it on your hard drive. But the practice of the Heart Sutra, there's two sides to the Heart Sutra. Heart Sutra is a Mahayana discourse. It's very short. It can be memorized. It's short enough that some people will chant the whole thing in one breath. So that gives you some sense how long it is. It fits on one page. And it's a very powerful and very significant sutra for, like, the Zen tradition. And it has a teaching of emptiness, that all things are empty. And everything's characterized by emptiness. So the practice coming out of the Heart Sutra is a practice of learning to recognize the emptiness of everything, how everything's characterized by this notion of emptiness. And in recognizing the emptiness of things, having no more fear about the world we live in, and becoming liberated in that process. But the practice of the Heart Sutra as a chant, it also has as a mantra. And as a mantra, it has a certain protective quality. And so this is where it kind of leaves the realm of what more or less is kind of logical, rational perhaps. You know, emptiness is supposed to be relative, can be explained relatively rationally. And into more the kind of mystical, you know, that this has a mantric, kind of mystical, mantric, almost magical power. And the chanting of it will protect you in many ways. You have to memorize it and learn to chant it. And memorize it so well that it's kind of second nature. It's ready to, the words of it are ready to bubble up at any given point. Which reminds me, when I taught a workshop this last week, one person was really struck by something I said. Traditionally in Buddhism, There's a big emphasis on memorization, on memorizing things, memorizing texts, memorizing sutras, memorizing chants. And people will spend, Buddhists will often spend a considerable amount of time, Buddhist practitioners, Buddhist monks, considerable amount of time memorizing different texts. And one of the reasons for this is that memorization strengthens the mind in various ways. It helps the mind stay, you know, the power of memorizing supposedly developed. But also, memorization is very closely related. The functions of the mind that's able to memorize is very overlaps quite a bit with those functions of the mind which is able to be mindful. Because both activities require holding something in the mind. In memorization, you're holding, you know, a text, for example, words in the mind. But in mindfulness, you're holding something in your experience. You're holding the present moment in your mind. You're holding your breath in the present moment. And this the connection between the two is seen also in the Buddhist words for are basically the same. Sati, smriti in Sanskrit, means both mindfulness and memory. So memorizing like the Heart Sutra or the Metta Sutta has a lot of benefits for practitioners that don't have to be mystical, but just that helps develop the mind. And as many of us realize, when we sit down to try to be mindful, it's quite nice to have some help. And you know, memorization is one way to help your powers of concentration and mindfulness. So that's, well, we actually have 3 more minutes. We can just end if that's all. But yes.
You know, I was reflecting on the depth of knowledge you seem to have about the Mahayana Zen approach and Vipassana. And I'm just curious, when you were exposed to Zen initially, that was sort of the scope of your world and your understanding. And then as you, I guess, got to know more about Vipassana, did you look back at Zen and see things differently? Or
sure.
Was it also alchemy and something different?
Well, certainly there was a kind of something happened in this body here, in this being here, that will, you know, you can't but help, but you know, somehow something hybridized or something kind of. I try to keep them somewhat separate, but you know, it's one thing to keep them separate, and one thing, you know, what's happened in my body, you know, but the. They both the traditions kind of helped inform each other, and I learned from both the traditions, and definitely. And I spent when I got involved with Vipassana, I spent a lot of time trying to reconcile the Vipassana practice with what I had learned or the sense of practice I had from Zen tradition. And it took actually a while to do that because I felt the two were actually initially I thought they were somewhat opposed to each other, very different. And but also as I went deeper into the Vipassana practice, I saw the Zen tradition and Zen teachings in different light, and began to appreciate the depth in the Zen tradition, which I hadn't realized was there or had misunderstood in different ways as I had earlier. So the two definitely, you know, it was really wonderful to do the two practices. And so it's very nice for me to have these sessions where I hear the kind of issues and concerns in your voices and all that. I hope that it's nice for you to have this kind of periodically this kind of exchange. And I'm very grateful for all of you. And I look forward to seeing you again when I can speak.